This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to Greg Tejeda, who is a reporter, covers Gary and other communities, Gary in particular, for the Post-Tribune. And Greg, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you very much. And yes, it has been a very busy time and weekend.
It's been crazy, I know, for the Common Council as well as everybody in the mayor's office, I understand. So let's talk first here about your story about what came out from the Common Council here concerning the need to kind of shift some money around here, some concern that has come out and has led to one person being suspended. And now I understand a contract for working that a retired member of the city staff is no longer going to be able to do. Tell us all about that.
Well, it seems that the city officials discovered earlier this year that there was a difference in the amount of money in an account that was meant for the fire department to use for emergency medical service expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Their records showed a certain amount of money that was supposed to be in that account, but then when they looked at the actual bank account and how much money was actually there, it was a $4 million difference.
Oh, my.
So they've been going back, trying to account for the difference. They've gone to their records back to the beginning of 2015, and it's up to about a $4.5 million difference now. And what they've figured out is it's not that the money has been spent on things that weren't legitimate government expenses, but apparently money was being transferred out of that account and just being used to cover other bills, in some cases payroll, mm-hmm. for other city agencies. And technically, according to the law, according to the procedures, the way they're supposed to be followed, each one of those transfers was supposed to have been brought to the council for their review and their approval. And because nobody ever did that, that accounted for the difference. Now, the thing is, they figure there's still that gap. They're continuing to look even further back beyond 2015, trying to figure out how far back this goes, how big a problem it is, how big a gap they have. But, you know, technically, this is money that was in the budget, you know, for the fire department to use, and it wound up getting put to other uses. Now, there are some members of the council who are very offended at this. They're outraged. They want somebody to pay for this. Others are trying to take the attitude that, well, the money was used for legitimate government purposes, and we do transfer money around. There is some talk that they may have to come back in coming weeks with some sort of big, massive ordinance detailing every single one of these transfers so that the council can approve it after the fact.
Yeah, I understand that the Common Council President, Ron Brewer, is one of those people who says that may have to make some adjustments here, and that might be it,
exactly.
I'm sure. Yeah.
This is still under investigation. You know, they've hired an outside accounting firm to review their books, and this is going to be ongoing for the next few months probably as we try to straighten out exactly how big a gap is there, mm-hmm. and just how out of control was there. I don't know if I should say out of control with this money, but you know, how loose was it that they weren't keeping track of where every single penny was going?
Yeah. Now, I know that the former city controller, Salita Green, I guess was technically responsible, I'm sure, all these years for that. And she's retired now, but I understand that she was gone into some consultancy work, and I understand that I guess the mayor put the kibosh to that.
Well, it would look pretty awkward if she was called in to investigate her own mess.
Yeah.
But, yes, she left back in February, and you know, there's a new controller in there now. So these people are trying to straighten out their books.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, with all the... This really is a semi-common practice with Gary, the way they're constantly having to transfer money around to cover their bills. You know, I don't want to say this is the least outrageous thing I've ever heard of, but it's not that much of a shock in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it was bound to happen if you're going to be constantly having to use what little money you have and juggling it around to make it all balance out.
Well, I guess this is what makes going to Gary Common Council meetings probably more interesting than if you went to, say, the Cedar Lake Town Board meeting or something like that, I would imagine.
I would say so.
I was going to hesitate to say the Hammond Common Council, but the Hammond City Council meetings are pretty interesting, too. I've been to some of those.
Yeah, well, I used to do the city council in Calumet City, Illinois, and that one can get just as wild at times.
I can imagine. So I guess this is on this particular issue. It's just stay tuned. We're going to see more changes, and maybe because the investigation from the outside accountancy firm is going to come up with something interesting, they're going to have to deal with whatever recommendations, I'm sure, from an outside view that will have to be done to deal with this.
Exactly. I expect to get many more stories out of this issue in coming months.
I would imagine. Now, also, Gary Common Council also recently took up the issue of wanting to do about some repair work to the Hudson Campbell Sports and Fitness Center, and there's some suggestions that maybe some more things need to be done, too, I understand. Fill us in on what the council has dealt with on that and coming up with the plans for the improvements.
It's been an ongoing project. Technically, it was supposed to have started back in 2012, but then problems arose. They didn't actually award contracts through 2015. Actual work didn't get underway until last year. And now they're near finishing the project, and they realized they didn't quite, you know, some things went up in cost. They needed to come up with another $282,000 to come up to finish off the project as far as it goes right now. Mm-hmm. And, yes, they had to transfer some money around, which was what was approved at their last council meeting. Basically, this final bit of work is the painting of the building itself. They're going to, instead of that dingy white that it's developed, it's now going to become sort of a gray, in large part because the soot, the mist, the smoke from the U.S. Steel plant nearby comes over and deposits it all over itself, all over the building, kind of makes it look dingy anyway, so they're hoping this will make it look less obvious.
Yeah, for folks that don't, where folks don't know where this is located, it's right in downtown Gary, just not very far from City Hall, I know.
And right across City Hall. It's between 4th and 5th Avenue.
Yeah, and right in wind of the U.S. Steel plant, too, yeah.
Yes. And now the thing that came up last week is that they realized that there's even more work that could still be done. So even though it's $282,000, that brings up the total bill to $2.97 million. It's supposed to finish the project off. Now they're talking about maybe we could use another $60,000 to really do this right. What they want to do is to improve the lighting around the building. Mm-hmm. Because particularly in the middle of winter when you get sundown at 4:30, that area can get pitch black. You know, it can be real dark around there. They'd like to make it more broadly lit so people feel a little more secure if they happen to be in the building in the middle of December in the evening.
Yeah,
so now they're figuring at some point maybe they'll be doing more transfers of the budget around to come up with another $60,000. Or it could just be put into next year's budget. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure that out.
Okay.
Then they can do this.
One of the other issues I know that has come up recently here is the makeup of the Gary City Library Board. And I think they've gotten some things resolved, I understand. Tell us from your story that you had posted in the Post Tribune's website and in the newspaper itself, how that's turned out.
They finally picked they filled the vacancy that they created over a month ago when they fired a member of the board. Technically, the Gary Library Board is run by 7 people on the board, one of whom is picked by the Common Council themselves, another by the mayor herself, 2 others by the Lake County Commissioners, and 3 others by the Gary School Corporation, or whoever happens to be running that entity at this point. Anyway, the council let go a month ago the person who they had picked 2 years ago for a 4-year term. They were of the opinion she wasn't doing her position, she wasn't filing the reports that were supposed to keep them apprised of what was going on. She wasn't showing up a lot of times. So they picked a new member to the board who's going to finish off the 2-year term. He'll be there through James Polk, not the former president. He will be there through July of 2019. And it turned out to be the same people who were opposed to letting go the old board member were opposed to bringing this guy in because they hated the whole process. They didn't like the idea that they were monkeying around with the board, playing around with its structure. Mm-hmm. There was no reason to do this, in their opinion. Whereas a majority of the council felt that if the person wasn't doing their job, they had to let him go.
Well, that's a good question that they came about there, and at least they've got this resolved, or it seems, at least for now. We'll find out about that, too. I know a story that you just had out there online and in print here of coming again from the Gary Common Council is talking about, I guess, the creation of the city's Port District Board. Tell us what the latest is on that, please.
Earlier this year, the Port Authority, whose 5 members were officially picked back in autumn of last year, they approved series of bylaws, the rules by which they will operate, and those bylaws were reviewed this week by the council and is likely to approve them when they meet again June the 6th at the Indiana University campus because they're still doing their tour of Indiana. They're trying to do repair work at City Hall. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they've pretty much established rules that a lot of government entities run themselves by. The one thing at this point, it is a non-salary board. These people are volunteers. They're not getting paid anything. And, in fact, technically, the Port District Board doesn't even have its own budget. However, they do have the authority to create a budget for themselves, which the council would then have to sign off on, which means in the future it is always possible they could give themselves some sort of salary for their work as they try to run the Port District in a way that would be a benefit to the city of Gary. Their hope is that if they... Technically, they designated the whole city of Gary as a port district, which means technically the kind of tax breaks that businesses can get for locating in a port district can now technically be applied to just about anywhere in Gary, mm-hmm. which city officials are hoping will help them attract more businesses to their city.
I know,
and that ultimately is the big purpose. It's not like anyone's really interested in bringing more ships in, although they wouldn't turn them away if they came.
Right. Yeah, I know that that's been a really, really big point that Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson has said that she wants to sell to the fact that the entire city can come under this district, and in turn that's going to mean some big, she hopes certainly, some big economic development opportunities for the city of Gary.
I hate to sound like a smart aleck, but the idea to me that anything around 53rd Street is in a port district strikes me as being a bit odd, but hey, what do I know?
that's true. It's a little far south from the lake, that's to be sure, and we know about that. Well, finally, Greg, I understand one of the stories that you had. I was talking, giving us an update here about the City of Gary's Youth Council. Tell us about that.
Gary, once again, has a youth council. It was originally created back in 2015. Members were picked from teenagers, all students at high schools in Gary. Were picked literally representing each district. It's almost like a miniature version of the Common Council itself. Mm-hmm. There is a youth council president. There is a secretary treasurer. Each district has its own representation. It's an 11-member board. And the original council's terms ran out after 2 years, at the end of 2016. Because of various delays, they didn't get underway to start picking a new council until October of last year. And they finally got around this month to approving the new members, and that they will take out their work for the next couple of years. The idea is they meet separately. They have adult common council supervision. It used to be Ron Brewer would sit in on their meetings and watch over them, make sure they were following proper process. And they discuss issues of concern to the city, particularly issues that could be of interest to young people. And then they ultimately come to their recommendations. They put together their reports, which then go to the adult council as a recommendation of sorts, which can then act on them or not act on them as they see fit. To give you an example, the old council board, the one that's, whose members have all moved on, they were the ones who actually did the debate, the study over the issue a couple of years ago when Gary was considering an ordinance that would make it a tougher penalty for young people who wore their pants drooping around their waist.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
Yes, yeah. And ultimately, the Youth Council recommended that perhaps these youthful offenders could be brought before what was being considered a youth court, where they could possibly be put to assorted penalties, most likely some sort of a work service or work.
Yeah, something like that. Something like where you to be able to kind of serve your time in
exactly.
some type of task of some sort. Yeah,
exactly. Nobody would be going to jail for this, but. Ultimately, however, the adult council decided not to take up the issue. They ultimately did nothing with it. You know, they let it sort of wither away. But the youth council did spend several months studying this issue, some serious discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were actually semi-intelligent people who had serious ideas, and there may be a future for them. We'll have to see if this new version of the youth council is equally qualified. Although I know city officials are claiming that they think they are, so maybe it's just me being overly skeptical.
Well, maybe the droopy pants issue will come back again. You just never know, do you, with this new youth council now?
It always could, although I'd like to think there are other things that they could be doing.
Yeah.
I'd hate to think they're going to re-debate the same issue over and over every time.
I wouldn't think so either, that's to be sure. So, Greg Tejeda covers the news for the City of Gary for the Post Tribune. And as always, Greg, thank you for being with us today. And we'll talk with you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Let's check in with Giles Bruce with the Times of Northwest Indiana on stories that he has worked on this week. Giles, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Now let's start out here talking about some students who are interested in being kings and queens and superheroes. It's all about an anti-violence conference. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah, so last Friday I attended the 2018 Youth Drug and Violence Prevention Conference at Indiana University Northwest. This is an annual conference where they bring in elementary, middle, high school students, to learn, basically how to avoid violence and drugs. And, they had some, very, very powerful speakers this year. And the first gentleman, Muhib Dyer, he's a motivational speaker from Milwaukee, and he gave a very, very passionate, powerful performance, where he basically encouraged them to be kings and queens, go back to their roots in a sense. He talked about how, black people, originated in, originally were in Africa and ruled their lands, and then were brought here as, to America's slaves, and now they're, kind of have come full circle where they're able to be president again. He showed Obama on screen, and, so he just encouraged them to, to kind of have that attitude that they can be kings and they can be, business owners and, really, bring the community, make the community shine.
Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned in your article that Mr. Dyer talked about some of the problems that he had faced with his family members, some violence on the streets in particular, involving his godson and all, and how he's turned all of that around to be able to encourage people not to get in trouble.
Yeah, he lost his godson to gun violence, and he, showed a shirt that he had with his godson's face on it and showed him on the screen, and gave kind of a passionate plea of why did you do this? I tried to stray you in the right direction, and it was just very powerful, and he I think he really made a difference in these kids' opinions going forward. And there's another really good speaker at the end, Northwest Indiana native and resident named Jeremiah Alessia. Talked to him about really just making use of your talents and also having good character to go along with it. And, I think that, these messages really, really got through to some of these kids.
I'm sure, too, that Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson was one of the speakers, too, and that she's the person that brought up the issue about superheroes. Tell us what she had to say, please.
Yeah, well, that was actually a theme of the conference. They call it Guardians of the 219 Realm, play on Guardians of the Galaxy. And yeah, it was just really, this was just trying to pump up these kids and motivate them. And her quote was that, the young people, you are superheroes. Let's protect the 219 realm. Let's, stop the violence that we, see too often on the streets here and kind of live a different way.
One of the other stories that you had in print and online recently here, too, talked about how Northwest Indiana hospitals are screening for a rather interesting, a little known, but a very potentially deadly disease, which stands for, the initials are PVD. Tell us what PVD stands for and why the hospitals are concerned and making sure that nobody contracts it.
Yeah, PVD is peripheral vascular disease. It is a disease, the symptoms include, fatigue, pain in the limbs, wounds that won't heal, like on the legs or arms. It happens when blood vessels are blocked and, mm-hmm. Circulation is inhibited to the arteries or to the limbs. From the vessels and arteries. And a common form of the condition called peripheral artery disease affects 12 million Americans. So it's a pretty common thing, but that's not something that gets a lot of attention and even from doctors. And, the hospitals, St. Mary Medical Center in Hobart, Community Hospital in Munster, and St. Catherine in East Chicago held these regular screening events every other month or so, where people can come in for free. I took the screening myself just mm-hmm. to get a feel for it. And, basically they just put these sensors on each of your big toes and two of your fingers and kind of test the circulation to make sure it's normal. And, luckily mine came back clean, but they were telling me that a lot of people, I think about 20% of the people have abnormal results and they mm-hmm. have to come back and, come back for more screening or potentially, treatment to treat the ailment.
The question I have is, too, it sounds like just what you mentioned in the article here, too, that some of the things that are considered as possibility as for signs that you may be contracting this is that are very similar as well to people that have diabetes, especially the question about wounds that won't heal and things like that.
Yeah, and it goes hand in hand a lot of times with diabetes. Yeah, diabetes is one of the main risk factors for it. Others are if you're a smoker, obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, history of heart attack, stroke, blood clots, being over the age of 50. So, if you have any of these, signs or symptoms, it might be a good idea to attend one of these screenings. They're free, and you can just call the hospitals to find out when they're taking place.
We're talking with Giles Bruce with the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that he has had online as well as in print here in recent days on the health scene and the like. And one of the other stories I know that you have that was interesting, too, is a fella was involved in a serious weight loss contest. And I guess he's looking to lose a lot of weight. And tell us about what Tom Modesto and his family members have gone through and why Tom is so very, very concerned about all this.
Yeah, well, this is... part of the Times weight loss contest we've been doing. This is the third year we've been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The first one we called Lose 16 and 16, then Lose 17 and 17, and now this is Lose 18 in 2018. So we found 18 local residents who are interested and motivated to lose weight, and we weigh them in once a month at a local gym and kind of follow them. We check in with them. Call them, go see them. They have a Facebook page where they communicate, and so we feature them every month. We kind of check in and do an article. So Tom Modesto, he's a semi-retired gentleman from Portage, and very motivated guy. He has some health issues. Type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. He wants to. Turn those things around. He has 6 grandchildren, including a newborn, that he wants to see grow up. So he's really, really motivated, really competitive guy. He told me he plans on winning the contest, and he's in second place
well,
so far. So
that's a very good attitude to take,
Yeah, and he's doing it alongside his wife, who is a city councilwoman from Portage, Liz Modesto. So they're in the contest together, so that's probably an extra motivator for them. So, just kind of a cool thing we do here at the Times, and it's fun to follow these people's progress throughout the year.
I know some of the other contestants that you mentioned in your article, too. Laura Pozuski is from Griffith. Ingrid Miller is from Valparaiso. All these people have, obviously, other than a late weight that they want to lose, do they have anything else in common?
So they all seem to have a motivation. It might be a little different. Like I mentioned, family wanting to see, kids and grandkids grow up. Laura said that, she struggled with depression and has already noticed her mood improving, from the exercise and healthy eating she's been doing. Ingrid is, another person who's very motivated and, has been following an interesting diet called the Scarsdale's Diet so far this year.
Mm-hmm.
That consists of, eating grapefruit and high-protein toast in the morning and then lots of protein and vegetables throughout the day. And she's been doing a lot of exercise. Actually, I walked around with her in a park in Munster the other day when we were chatting, so I got a little workout myself during that interview. So, it's just, whatever their motivation is, it's always, something very, personal and important to them. So that's, a way for them to be successful in this contest.
Well, it's nice to hear that some folks out there are having some success in following through on promises they've made to themselves and their family to be able to lose weight, to be able to be healthier and stay around a lot longer if they can do so. We've been talking with, dare I say it, the Times health and fitness guinea pig, Giles Bruce, who covers other things too for the Times of Northwest Indiana. As always, Giles, thank you for spending time with us here on Ridgely Speaking, and we'll look forward to some more stories from you soon.
Yeah, thank you as always. Take care.
Thank you. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we are talking with Andrew Steele with the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that he has worked on and put out in print as well as online. Andrew, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk here a little bit first here about the South Shore Line fare increases. We've kind of brought this up sometime back. I guess it was discussed and approved, but it finally took effect. And what kind of impact is going to have on the commuter railroad?
Well, it'll raise prices by about 50 cents or so for most of our local commuters. That'll be for a one-way ticket into the city. Monthly ticket prices will go up from around $9.50 in Hammond and East Chicago to $14.25. That's the increase in Michigan City. So it's about a 5% increase across the board.
Did it seem to come down to when they had the number of public hearings on this before the board finally approved it that many people seemed to complain or that they seemed to be, I guess, resigned to the fact that it costs more to take the train and there's good reasons for it?
Yeah, a couple things I'd say. First of all, there were not a whole lot of people who showed up.
Yeah.
Fewer than 15, I think, people showed up. And then they got some comments online and things. But for the most part, people were accepting of it. One of the things about it is that it's meant to pay for the operation of what's called the positive train control system, which is essentially an automated system that will stop trains in the event of an emergency. And that's a federally mandated project. And they're going to need to hire 10 or so employees, get increased insurance coverage, things like that, once they get this implemented at the beginning of next year.
I know that some of this discussion has come about, too. I know in large part with all the publicity, unfortunately bad publicity, with all the train wrecks that have happened involving Amtrak trains and other commuter lines, I guess, that have been resolved because of people not necessarily, I guess, falling asleep at the switch, but things happening and not being aware of them.
Yeah, it would be basically catch engineer errors, prevent collisions, prevent derailments caused by going too fast, which is something we've seen with Amtrak, and then also helping out at switching, make sure that the train's on the right track.
I know that one of the story also covered as well some of the other things that the South Shore Line is planning on doing, and one of those big things on the list is improving the Metro Center. And Gary, tell us about that.
Yeah, and now this project is for essentially their station there.
Right.
And so the Metro Center, we think, is the main building there. But it really, that complex kind of extends all the way to Broadway. And so the South Shore station extends that far east, and they have an entrance off of Broadway. And so there's going to be a lot of work there just to make it more welcoming, to replace the elevator, which has had some maintenance issues, get rid of the escalator, which escalators are high maintenance, and so they think they can get away with just a good elevator there. And then do a lot of painting and water sealing, stuff like that, just to make it a safer and more
pleasant experience. I understand, too, that I guess that part of the deal of what they want to do there at the Gary Metro Center is to have a standby way to move the trains around, I guess, if something happens. And we know the overhead wires sometimes fail, and sometimes there are power outages and things like that can mess things up, and they've got a kind of a backup plan, don't they?
Yeah, they're going to lease with the option to buy a diesel locomotive. They already have one. They're going to have another one now there at Gary. And it would be used in emergency situations. If electricity's out, they can't run the trains.
Yeah.
And so they would use the diesel to do that.
One of the other stories I know you had as well, too, in print online, was talking about the newly paved Erie Lackawanna Trail that's located here in Lake County. Tell us about that and about some of these other trail upgrades that have been happening.
Yeah, that was done this spring, repaving. It was a kind of a rough stretch along there. Over the years, it had developed some cracks and some roughness, so that's been smoothed out. They're going to do a lot with wayfinding signage. There are a lot of comments that people have is they don't know at certain points exactly where they are, what town they're in. They don't know how many miles they've gone. And so there are going to be things like that to help people know where they are, know how far they've gone, things like that. A lot of these projects are not really long. It might be a bridge, might be a short section of trail, but it's all based on connecting the network
and
filling in the gaps.
it seems that they've worked very hard, and in particular Mitch Barloga with NERPSI, since that's his basic job is to keep track of all of this and try to help push these trails along. They've worked very hard to make sure that everything is connected well, and that's one of the advantages here in Northwest Indiana, that the trail system is pretty well connected with just a few breaks, I guess, in between places, as opposed to some counties further south that have great stretches of land that basically don't have trail connections at all.
Yeah, and we benefit here from the amount of railroads that have passed through, and I know people don't necessarily like to think about the trains, freight trains coming through, but there's so much that's been abandoned by the railroads, and not abandoned, but just that they stopped using, that becomes available for these types of trails. And so that, a lot of the names come from the Erie Lackawanna Trail,
right.
Pensy Greenway, that's all old railroad.
And finally, Andrew, I know one of the stories that you also had, too, was a big story here about the recent regional transportation summit. You got a chance to sit in on some of it. Tell us how it's all gotten together and what the purpose of that summit was and what you heard in the time that you were able to spend there at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond and put together for your story.
Yeah, it's really about connectivity. It's about people being able to get to jobs, to get to shopping, to get to recreational activities within the region, and then to Chicago, of course. But a lot of the summit was about the bus service. So the Gary Public Transportation was a big part of putting it together, and they've been working hard, sometimes on a shoestring budget, to expand service, to speed service up along Broadway in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it talks about providing that accessibility to everyone and to every community, to abled and disabled people, in order to be able to get where they need to go.
I know that's been one of the concerns. I know that Daryl Lampkins even voiced when we had a chance to talk with him about the problems of GPTC is because of having to take on so many different routes when the RBA, the Regional Bus Authority, went out of business, and that in turn forced a way to find a way to be able to continue the route south out of Hammond down into Highland and other places too. People were taking those buses and getting around to places, and they needed to have the connectivity, as you mentioned, to keep those routes going.
Yeah, and the RBA, a decade or so ago now, was one potential solution to get to get the entire county into this. Right now they do struggle with keeping some of those routes going. I know actually Hammond, the city of Hammond, has pitched in to keep their routes going financially, but. Yeah, long term, it would probably take something like an RBA to.
Well, we'll have to find out about how things develop there too. And that's certainly what I know that the summit was all about, was to get stakeholders and everybody else involved in this, to get them thinking about ways to improve public transportation here in particular in Lake County and probably other counties in Northwest Indiana as well too. We've been talking with Andrew Steele, who covers transportation issues and other things as well related for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Andrew, thank you for being with us today on the program, and we'll hope to have you back on again soon.
All right, thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our sister station, Lakeshore PBS, is airing a documentary this Memorial Day holiday that was made possible by many, including a local who helped produce the movie, and the film proves to be educational, entertaining, and eye-opening as it informs viewers of everything that happened in Chicago during World War II.
World War II was total war, as much industrial as military. Pitting the massive manufacturing might of the United States against the Axis powers. Germany, Japan, and Italy. While not immediately apparent to our enemies, the U.S. had three distinct advantages. Its location was far from the battlefield. There were plentiful natural resources. And there was a huge, diverse workforce positioning the U.S. for victory.
A City at War, Chicago. A new documentary by executive producer, writer-director John Davies, and by a co-executive producer, editor and director of photography, Ryan Callies, and hosted by Bill Curtis, makes its national public television premiere this Memorial Day weekend on more than 100 stations. Lakeshore Public Radio spoke with Callies, who back in 2005 was a production manager at Lakeshore Public Television. He is now living in Los Angeles and making documentaries like A City at War Chicago, which will air on Lakeshore PBS on May 28th at 9 p.m. So, Brian, what is the film about?
City at War Chicago is about nearly everything that happened in Chicagoland during World War II. And we're talking about production, we're talking about the political landscape, the neighborhoods, the different ethnic groups. There are German internment camps that took place in Chicago, the development of the atomic bomb, Nazi spies, and of course, there were a lot of soldiers and sailors at that time. So the mob used it as an opportunity to make money off them with gambling and prostitution. So we talk about basically everything that happened in Chicagoland during the war.
Companies making cars, toys, and appliances would start producing guns, planes, and tanks.
In your opinion, what are the best parts of the film?
I really have an affection for old propaganda movies, partly because they're just so corny, but also they were really earnest, and this was how they got information out to people. And so we used a lot of old propaganda movies as they were intended, but we also kind of stole their imagery to illustrate a lot of the things that we needed illustrating in the film. So they really came in handy that way. So one particular part, I can't say. I just think I'm really happy with the fact that we were able to find so much great footage and so much great color footage. It's getting harder and harder to find film from that era that no one has already seen before.
Yeah, how did you guys find all that?
We have an excellent researcher, Polly Pettit, in Washington, D.C., and we kind of do our own online searches and look through the National Archives and kind of put the troll out for any home movies. We're really big into home movies, John Davies and I, the director, and we like to use stuff that you haven't seen before. So we really do deep dives into archives that haven't been transferred from film yet, or we get home movies that just haven't been ever seen by anyone outside of the family.
What inspired you to make this film?
We made a film a couple years ago called Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan. And it's the story of how more than 100 World War II airplanes ended up on the bottom of Lake Michigan. There was an aircraft carrier training program that went on in the 40s, during World War II rather, because it was protected. You couldn't train pilots on aircraft carriers in the West or East Coast or Gulf of Mexico for fear of enemy submarines and attack. So someone had the bright idea, we have an inland sea. It's called the Great Lakes. So in doing that story, we came across a statistic that said more than 40% of all war material made in World War II came out of Chicago.
Coastal cities shouldered much of the burden, but Midwestern cities like Detroit and especially Chicago were of vital importance too.
We thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. We kind of filed that away. And then as we were sort of touring with that film, we realized, you know, someone should really tell the story of what happened in Chicago during World War II. And then we thought, well, why don't we tell that story? So we kind of started looking more into the subject, and we found that not only the manufacturing, but as most people know, in the area, Chicago is a city of neighborhoods. So you had Japanese neighborhoods, you had Polish, you had Greek, you had Black, you had Hispanic, you had all the ethnic groups, all the racial groups. And really, everyone had to come together to sort of to fight the Axis.
I remember a boy in the neighborhood was killed in action. And the whole neighborhood, different ethnic groups, Polish, Greek, Armenian, the whole neighborhood went into a kind of mourning. He was a son for every family.
Companies became weaponized, so to speak. Companies that were once making tin cans are now making torpedoes.
Companies making cars, toys, and appliances would start producing guns, planes, and tanks.
Companies that were once making cars are now making Jeeps and plane engines. Even the Chicago Roller Skate Company, who were making roller skates, they ended up making grenades. Everybody was involved, so it was all hands on deck. Every man, woman, and child, race, color, or creed, had to get involved and, you know, defeat a clear evil, you know, the Nazis.
The most notable saboteur was Hans Haupt. Born in Germany, he emigrated to Chicago with his parents and he spoke English without a trace of a German accent. He was a member of the Lane High School ROTC, and it was recalled how much he loved wearing that uniform. He would strut around the house in that uniform.
Ultimately, Haupt returned to Germany to enroll in the Abwehr, the German spy school, where he and his small group were trained to sabotage railway lines, essential wartime factories, and if possible, steal secrets.
So what was Northwest Indiana's involvement during World War II?
Northwest Indiana, as many people know, heavy-duty steel production. U.S. Steel is there. Inland Steel was there at the time. So anything that you needed heavy steel with, which is basically everything that you need to make a tank or a plane or a Jeep or a gun, came out of Northwest Indiana. But as far as there's also, throughout the whole state, there were places like Allison's Airplane Engines, Studebaker, Eli Lilly made plasma, Calumet Region for Steel, Guide Lamps made cartridge cases, South Bend Toys made tent poles. So really, it was, again, all hands on deck. Every company that was making non-war material before the war was now employed to make war material. So Northwest Indiana was a huge steel producer. Massive amounts of steel came out of that area at the time.
You once worked at Lakeshore Public Television.
I was a production manager at WYIN, now Lakeshore Public Media, back in 2005, I believe. And we did everything from commercials and news and programs and all of that, and always had a love for the area. I grew up in Cedar Lake, actually. I love telling Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana stories. So it's great that Lakeshore is going to be running City at War.
And tell us when that's running again.
It's going to be running Memorial Day, May 28th at 9 p.m.
The man who lived across the street from us came out of his house, running down the steps. "The war is over," he said. "The war is over."
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Some good news here in Northwest Indiana today for the preservation of a very important part of the city of Gary's history. And to find out more about it, let's check in with Brad Miller. He is the office manager of the Northwest Indiana Regional Office of Indiana Landmarks, which his office based in Miller. And he is going to tell us all about a preservation award that's gone out and also, too, about all the efforts to try to preserve another part of Northwest Indiana history as well, too. Brad, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first talking about the very special preservation award that Centere Bank has received for their branch, which is located on Broadway in downtown Gary.
Yeah, certainly. So we just recently awarded our Adaptive Reuse Award to Centere Bank for their sensitive rehabilitation of the former storefront at the Gary State Bank building on Broadway.
What seemed to impress the folks in Indianapolis about this project and why they seem to feel that it's a really good way of reusing a building in this particular case?
Well, yes, certainly. Not only did they really implement the historic space of the building in the on the first floor there, so they actually were able to salvage doors, woodwork, and vintage ceramic tile from the air from the 1920s when it was constructed, to create a bank lobby feel from the era. And most importantly, we do see preservation as a real source of revitalization, and Centere's decision to move a bank branch to downtown Gary certainly showed their commitment to Gary and the revitalization of the historic buildings in that area.
Now, I know there's been some other projects in Northwest Indiana that have also picked up similar preservation awards from Indiana Landmarks. Tell us a little bit about these two, in particular, Dan and Mary Beth Maddox, restoration of a very beautiful house.
That was an award before my time, but they were two homeowners down in Rensselaer, and there's a lot of beautiful historic homes down in Rensselaer. Theirs in particular was this wonderful craftsman bungalow in a historic neighborhood just across the Iroquois River from downtown. And with any, you know, historic home, it's a big task, and it takes a lot of heart to put forth the effort to help preserve those types of homes and to preserve them over time and to maintain them. Preservation is maintenance, and that's literally backbreaking work to keep it up and running. And then we also recently awarded in the past few years, the Porter County Museum for their educational programs across Porter County, particularly their focus on Beverly Shores and the long history, stretching back to Robert Bartlett and his original development of the area.
We're talking with Brad Miller. He is the director of the Indiana Landmarks Northwest Indiana Field Office, and he's based out of the Miller neighborhood of Gary. We've noted, too, in recent weeks that Indiana Landmarks has put out the 10 most endangered facilities list across the state, some landmarks that really, really are in serious need of care and preservation, to be sure. One of them here in Northwest Indiana is St. Joseph's College. Give us a little history about the concern that Indiana Landmarks has had over time about this and what they're hoping that not only folks in the university community but elsewhere might step up and be able to help preserve this university, certainly the physical campus.
Certainly, yeah. So our 10 most lists we put out every year in May, and those resources and buildings can stretch the far gamut of what endangered really means. So they could be, you know, literally on the cusp of falling down, or in this case, they could be without a use. And in this case, a huge campus, you know, more than 25 buildings without a use. So that was our main concern getting drawn to the idea of listing it. And the campus also boasts a long range of architectural styles, stretching all the way back to the first building before even college even started in 1888, which is Drexel Hall, stretching all the way to the 1960s, which St. Joe's has a great collection of mid-century modern architecture that was all designed by local architect Frank Fisher. So we saw, you know, this collection of architectural heritage and gems, the St. Joe's campus. We just wanted to raise awareness and kind of open communication and discussion with the remaining administration there to really look for pathways forward to help preserve mm-hmm. these buildings.
Now, we know that the folks that are working hardest right now to be able to get the campus opened up again as an institution of higher learning, trying to work out an arrangement with Marion University in Indianapolis to have them open it up as a two-year college. Do you think that they and some other folks working on this particular project are certainly looking at the campus as a whole and trying to see what kind of help that they can get from other sources to be able to get this preservation work done?
Certainly, yeah, and we certainly applaud all the work that they're putting forward and talking with them. I know it's a tireless effort. And then there, you know, the proposed plan that they most recently included 8 buildings as kind of the core of the rebirth of St. Joe's.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly doesn't cover a lot of the whole campus, particularly the science building, which is a 1914 collegiate Gothic building, and the Halleck Student Center, which is a fantastic mid-century building from 1962. So just working with that administration and figuring out ways to possibly put together a maintenance plan or a mothballing plan to get those buildings not in use, sealed up and tight so that the elements don't really continue to eat away at them, that historic buildings, you know, are particularly prone to, get those closed up and then work with the leadership to figure out maybe if there's a new use in the community aside from this rebirth of a new two-year program
mm-hmm.
In partnership with Marion yeah. University.
Now, Brad, if anybody is interested in helping do something their own part to help in this preservation project, or any, for that matter, any preservation project of any structure in Indiana through Indiana Landmarks, how can they find out more about these particular projects and what they in turn can do?
Well, certainly. You can go to our website, which is www.indianalandmarks.org. Or you can also call the regional office here in Miller, and my number is 219-947-2657. And we're more than happy to always take a call and figure out maybe if you're facing a challenge or if you're interested in getting involved and volunteering, we're more than happy to have you.
Now, does the state of Indiana offer any kind of assistance financially, if it's possible, to be able to help people that want to do preservation projects?
Yeah, and we certainly take advantage of a full array of financial incentives for preservation from private foundations and not-for-profits, tax incentives from the state and federal government, as well as grant programs at the state and federal level. So we really do look at all funding sources and opportunities and see how they fit with that particular project.
Brett Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Brett Miller is the director of the Indiana Landmarks Northwest Indiana Field Office. It's based out of the Miller neighborhood in Gary. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. And thanks as well to the reporters who are with us for Reporters Roundtable Thursday. From the Times, we have Giles Bruce and Andrew Steele. Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune, and then Sharon Jackson with Lakeshore Public Radio joined us with her feature on the PBS documentary coming up. And we hope that you have a great holiday weekend. We're taking Monday off, but Regionally Speaking, we'll be bringing you a special feature commemorating the Memorial Day holiday, and we'll be back on Tuesday.